This morning, if you would, I would ask that you turn in your Bibles with me to the book of Genesis, and we're going to be looking in chapter 1, and we are going to be reading the beginning of verse number 1, and certainly as we look at these words this day, they are words that are familiar to us, and as we look into the subject of what I've been telling you for several weeks that we would begin to look at, which is the subject of evolution and really the refutation of evolution. Whereas it may be true that our younger people, certainly from middle school age to, and really sometimes even stretching back to elementary and it's in very small forms, but our younger ones stretching forth from that age all the way through college are ones that are you know, having to deal with the subject of evolution sometimes very often, and it's good for them to understand, of course, that first of all, evolution is not a fact, and as we will look at this subject, we will see that this idea of evolution is full of many flaws that cannot be answered as well. But for those that are older in nature, which certainly outnumber our younger here, but for those that are older in nature, this does not excuse you from listening or trying to understand this. And the reason being is because we live in a nation today that is increasingly identifying themselves as atheists as far as people goes, the population goes. There are more people claiming to be atheists than any other time in this nation's history. And those are people that you are going to deal with as you go out into the world and you may start to say something, but you know, they're coming from a belief structure that has been instilled in them that there is no God. And certainly if there is no God or any intelligent design, then evolution must become then their way of thinking that man exists. Evolution itself then becomes even its own moral compass as to the purpose of life as well. And because more people are identifying themselves this way, you need to learn how to speak to them this way. It's the same way that you would speak to someone. You need to know what somebody from the Church of Christ believes, someone from the Catholic Church believes, someone from the Methodist Church believes. It's good to know those things and to understand those things so that you can talk to them about the Word of God as you witness to them. But now, back to Genesis chapter 1, and I want you to bear with me because we're going to read several verses. In fact, we're going to read the whole chapter. So if you would, Genesis in chapter 1, it says in verse 1, you all know it, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness, and called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And the evening and the morning were the second day. And God said, let the waters under heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, and herb yielding seed, and the fruit yielding fruit after its kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and herb yielding seed after its kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament in the heaven, to give light upon the earth, and it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. Kind of just a side note. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light and the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and the fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the waters and the seas, and let the fowl multiply in the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast upon the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image and our likeness, and let him have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree, and which is in the fruit of the tree, yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat, and to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat also. And it was so. And God saw everything that he hath made, and behold it, and it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. What we have just read, taking the time to read, of course, is the biblical account of creation. Here we have actually the origin of the universe, which God spoke into creation. He did not bring these things out of something that already exists. He did not collect what was there and make them and mold them. Indeed, he created the universe and all that is within it just by speaking it. All that ever was, all that will ever be. Secondly, our text describes for us the biblical account of the origin of the species. On what the Bible calls the fifth day, God created life by speaking life into the waters, told them to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the seas. And on the fifth day, God also spoke the fowls of the air into existence and told them to be fruitful and to multiply upon this earth. And then upon the sixth day, he made the beast of the fields, the forest, and the jungles, and lastly the crown of all of his creation, which was man, whom he made in his own image, made from the dust of the ground. And of course, as we read in chapter 2, as he made woman from the rib of the man. But all of this universe, the earth, the creatures of the sea, the fowls of the air, the beasts of this earth, and finally man, all were created for a purpose. And we know this purpose biblically was to give God glory. To bring God glory. In fact, all of creation truly bears out that there must be a creator. And this is why Paul in the book of Romans in the first chapter tells us that man is without excuse. Man is without excuse. It has often been said for the Christian that if you do not believe Genesis 1 and therefore Genesis 1, 2, and 3, then you are left without nothing. That is, you have no explanation of sin. You have no explanation for the need of a Savior. It has been said that if you don't believe in Genesis chapter 1, then you can pick and choose whatever chapter you want to exclude thereafter. As you know, for most of history, the Jew and the Christian, for both of those sects, no one really doubted the truth of the creation account. It's kind of rare to find that. Today, though, Christians try to hold on to what they believe is sound science and the Bible. They find themselves in a real pickle trying to compromise one or the other. First, they can believe that what we just read is primitive man's account of history, that it's taken or should be taken as nothing more than a story, an allegory, and not reality. Many Christians believe that. By the way, that is the official stance of the Roman Catholic Church. Secondly, they can try to mix science and religion itself and come up with things by reading things into the text like the gap theory that would take place between verses 1 and 2, where there is destruction or creation and destruction, maybe even multiple creations and destructions that occurred over millions, if not billions, of years until we come to this specific creation. Where some would prefer to take the route of stretching out the days, the so-called days of creation, and stretch them into millions, if not billions, of years to allow the duration of time needed for an old earth and evolution to take place according to God's plan. Or thirdly, they can accept the Bible and seemingly reject science. And notice I said seemingly reject science. Well, the truth is that none of those options, those three things that I just mentioned, are good options for a critical thinking Christian. The question must be asked, is the science sound upon which evolution stands? And I do believe that the answer to that is no. And I believe, furthermore, that when you get down to it, that for those who espouse evolution, for them, in the end, it must boil down to faith as well. You see, I have faith in Genesis chapter 1, and they have faith in what they believe. I have faith that God created the universe, the earth, light, that God separated the waters, created the dry lands, created the vegetation, created the sun, the moon, the stars, created the creatures of the sea and the birds that fly. That He created land animals, and in the end, that God created man in His own image. Evolution. They must also have faith. They must have faith that nothing created the universe. That the universe created the stars. That the stars created the heavy elements. That the stars exploded. That the universe created the planets. That a planet created life by first creating simple organic molecules. Then created amino acids. Then created proteins, then created enzymes or RNA, then created DNA, then DNA created life. The first life was simple, supposedly, but evolved and got more complex. That's faith. That's faith as well. One thing that I am constantly amazed at is when you listen to someone who espouses evolution, as they talk about it, as they describe it to you in all of their excitement, they will talk about those little leaps of evolution. And they'll use terms like this. They'll say, evolution wanted to do this. Evolution wanted to make this better. Evolution wanted to camouflage itself to protect itself in its environment. Evolution wanted to do this and that. And they talk about evolution as if it had some kind of mystical will that is behind it, a force that is causing it to push forward. Maybe they should call it the spirit of evolution. Or in Star Wars terms, the Force. But something to that nature. So as you look at believing the Bible, or as you look at believing in evolution, it is always brought back to faith. We have faith in one, they have faith in the other. My faith is in what the Bible says. Their faith is based on human reasoning and what is considered so-called scientific observation. Now, there's one scientific field that promotes evolution more than the rest, and it is biology. Polls show that biologists believe in God less than any other branch of science. I was completely unaware of that before I began this journey. The cornerstone quote of biology seems to have come in 1973, when a scientist by the name of Theodosius Dobzhansky, I'm probably saying that wrong, published in the American Biology Teacher the following quote that has been used over and over again. Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. He went on to say, without that light, it becomes a pile of sundry facts, some of them interesting or curious, but making no meaningful picture as a whole. Here we see that he believed that evolution gives biology life and gives to it a purpose. A purpose. It gives it meaning, as just opposed to the collection of information. Now, I don't know about you, but I spent quite a bit of time around a chemistry lab, and it was dealt with collecting information. Facts. That's what we did. Nobody ever talked about it having life. A meaning. But again, you see in his quote, the spirit of evolution, that there is some kind of universal grand scheme from the first cell to the development of man to some future superhuman that is yet to exist, still waiting to evolve. Biologists have faith in their religion, and their religion is evolution. And their churches are found in science buildings on public and private colleges around this world, and attendance is mandatory in their sanctuary. And great animosity is held against scientists who do not agree with their vision of science. To step away from Darwinian evolution at times puts scientists working at universities in danger of losing their jobs, and certainly to find themselves at odds with other professors. So, before we get into the refutation of evolution, we need to look at some certain things here, and certainly we need to look at where the modern notion of evolution first came from, and understand that Charles Darwin was not the very first person who ever thought any of these thoughts. There are certainly others throughout time that have done so, but his book, Origin of the Species, was first published on November 24th, 1859. If you watch Facebook, I'm sure on November 24th, there'll be somebody posting something wonderful about Darwin on November 24th. That usually happens. But he published this after 20 years of observation and data keeping. His work, Origin of the Species, is considered by scientists to be one of the most important books that has ever been written, encompassing thoughts of fields that had not yet been established, such as genetics. Charles Darwin has been placed upon the top 20 lists of the most notable geniuses of all times. You'll often find him right there, usually not in the top 10, but usually in the top 20. Truly, the world thinks a lot about Charles Darwin. So what is it that Darwin purposed or proposed in a nutshell? Well, first of all, I want you to understand that Darwin had nothing to do with explaining a Big Bang theory or any other kind of theory of how the Earth came into existence. His book, Origin of the Species, is just that. It starts with the origin of a species on an Earth that already exists. He fully has a starting point. He has a starting point, but no mechanism of beginning. If you look at the slide there, you'll see some look like chicken paw prints or footprints or whatever you call them up there, chicken scratch. That's one of his first drawings. And what that has become known as is the tree of life. The tree of life. The idea is, as Darwin looked originally at a group of plants that lived in the same area, that he believed that they must have a common ancestor. And over thousands of years of generations, because of varying conditions and climate, or even location, it caused certain plants to diversify in nature in response to the struggle to survive. For instance, we could say that a plant that has a broad leaf may have survived better in a certain area because that broad leaf helped protect its roots. But in another location where it was more important for the rain to get to the roots, maybe it was drier, the leaf might not be as broad. So those two plants may have been nearly identical thousands of years ago, but over time and over location and over need and over the struggle to survive, what we have are vastly different plants. In the end, one who has very thin leaves, one who has very broad leaves, and they look nothing like each other. You wouldn't classify them together, and they look nothing like their original ancestor. That's kind of the idea behind things. Based on this thought process, Darwin eventually concluded that all of life could be traced back to a common ancestor, evolving through the process of natural selection and the struggle to survive. He wrote, "Therefore, I should infer from the analogy that probably all organic beings which have ever lived on this earth have descended from some primordial form into which life," get this, "was first breathed." That's the language they use. He thought this first form of life probably came from a warm pond. This process, of course, would take a lot of time. A much greater time than Darwin ever imagined, as scientists have now, you know, pieced this together. Today, scientists believe that life first emerged from that primordial ooze somewhere between 2.5 to 3 billion years ago. Now, you might recall, some of you all who are younger, or older, I should say, older, that when you were in school, that number was a lot smaller. But as time has went on, we've needed more time to, in order to get these things done. So what used to be millions or maybe a billion is now stretching back to billions upon billions of years. For many years, really up into the 1990s, the modern tree of life diagrams were based upon geology. And what the thought process was is that they would do a dig, and in the higher up strata were the more recent animals, and then as they dug lower, that they would be the ones that had been around longer, ones that had been extinct longer. And they would look at the similarities between certain things. They'd say, well, here we have vertebrates, and these must be linked together, and here we have invertebrates, and these all must be linked together. The thought process is eventually they would come back to a common ancestor. Since the 90s, though, the field of genetics is the preferred playground of the biologist and the study of evolution. By looking at common genetic traits, scientists group life into what they call phylogenetic trees, all the way back to a common ancestor called Luca, which is the last universal, I got to figure out what it is now, last universal, I forget what it's called, common ancestor, last universal common ancestor. So that ancestor, of course, isn't known. That's the one that would have existed somewhere around 2.5 to 3 billion years ago. And eventually, over time, we have it split into these three trees here, these three different groups. Now, you'll notice the eukaryotes at the top, and those are the ones capable of the most or greatest potential in forming multicellular organisms. And this supposedly began over a billion years ago when it first developed into protozoa, and then plants, and amoeba, fungi, worms, shellfish, insect, followed by fish, sharks, amphibians, and then branching off into reptiles and birds in one branch, and mammals in the last branch, of course, with man at the top. Now, for some of you all, you may be looking at this and going, well, I thought evolution taught that man came from monkeys, right? Y'all remember that? Well, Darwin definitely believed that man descended from apes. But scientists today will be quick to tell you that man did not come from monkeys as we know them today, or apes as we know them today, but rather we had a common monkey ancestor. Still sounds like we came from monkeys. All right? You can't get away from it. Now, what I've tried to do in our time together so far this morning is just to give you a, in the most simple terms that I think I can do, of what evolution is and what it states. The question we must ask ourselves, though, is it really possible? Is evolution possible? Is it possible that small adaptive changes over time due to random mutations, because of the struggle of life, could cause the diversity of life that we see today, given enough time? I believe the answer is absolutely not. And the purpose of this lesson and the lesson that will follow, if not two more lessons that will follow, is to give you reasons as to why that I don't believe it is possible. And we're going to use science as our guide and helper. And in the end, I think you will see that the old phrase is certainly true, that if you walked into a forest and you found a pocket watch, you would assume that it had a creator. And certainly, the same is true for man. The diversity and complexity of life indeed points to the need of a maker. Some call it intelligent design. I call it creation. So the first step in looking at the impossibility of evolution is to consider the question of, is it possible for a living cell to be born out of chance? Out of chance. Remember, the theory of evolution takes us back to a single cell from which all of life began. So can chance and the right ingredients and the right warm pond create life? Most modern biology books just assume that it is possible, and they assert it to be true. Very common biology textbook says, the earth was formed from a cloud of condensing cosmic dust and gas about 4.5 billion years ago. Life arose soon thereafter. They just assert that it is true. But can life come from non-living matter? To answer this question, we must understand the complexity of even the most simple of cells. Just one living cell is a complex network of complex molecules. In order for a cell to form, inorganic molecules would randomly have to come together in a specific order over and over again until the cell structure could be formed. And even at that, the cell would not be alive. It would only be a structure. And then for life to exist, hundreds of metabolic processes would then somehow have to be initiated all at the same time, with all of the intermediates already in place and ready to go as well. Let's think of a factory for a moment. A factory that makes shoes. This is my feeble attempt at trying to explain this. And let's think about it as being the most simple shoe that one could make. A flip-flop. A flip-flop. There's not much in a flip-flop, right? But this factory must have randomly developed the brick, the mortar, everything about the factory had to randomly develop in an orderly fashion to form the walls, the floor, the ceiling, everything in it. By the way, it also had to randomly make the conveyor belts, the machinery, and all that was necessary inside of it. It would also have to form the components that were necessary to make the shoes. There had to be a way to make the foam for the flip-flop, the thong part of the flip-flop. All that has to be formed before you ever get started so that it can put the pieces together. So as you can imagine, that this randomly existing flip-flop factory with all of its pieces and all of its places in order for life to exist, then somehow someone must come and turn on the electricity and start the process. But the process isn't really started just by turning on the electricity, because the fact is we think of like a conveyor belt, we can think of like something coming out of the machine and putting it up there and going through the process. No, in order for this to really function the way that a cell would, not only do you have to have the product that you're starting with, the raw product already here, you've got to have the finished product that's going out in the shipping already, and raw materials already coming into the cell, and everything happening all at once. Everything has to be in place in order for life in the factory to exist. You see, a cell, a living cell, is like an orchestra. There are no solos. It starts just like that, and it ends just like that. If we stop one part, if the trumpets fade off, if the violins stop, it's death to the orchestra or to the factory if the conveyor belt stops or whatever it is. So everything has to happen all at once. So is it possible by chance that the simplest cell could have randomly formed? Well, scientists have tried to make it happen over and over and over again, and they can't make it happen. Science has not been able to produce life from death. As a matter of fact, they can't even take a dead cell that has all the pieces there and make it live again. When we start to look at probability and chance, there is another person that surfaces on the college campus, and that is the mathematician. You all have heard the phrase, the math doesn't lie. That's one thing I always liked about math, is when you get an answer, it's the answer. There's just no other answer. That's it. Now, there are some guys that really like to sit around and crank numbers, and I'm thankful for that. I take my hat off to them. I think they're all geniuses. Now, you've heard people say the phrase that there is no chance that something could happen. Well, many of the things that we say that for, there actually is a slight chance that it could happen. There's a slight chance that many things could happen. Minuscule in nature, but it could happen. I could walk into this building and turn on the light switch, and there is a chance that this whole building will burn down. There is that chance. It's small, but it's there. Well, mathematicians have figured out that chance can be eliminated when chance exceeds 1 in 10 to the 150th power. Now, that's 50 more zeros than a Googleplex, which is the largest number known to man. That's where Google gets its name. It's a big number. But at that level, there is zero chance that it could ever happen in this known universe. And people that are far smarter than us have looked at the biology and the math and have added the calculations together and calculated that the chances of a single cell forming by chance is 10 to the 190th power, far greater than the number needed to eliminate chance altogether. A team of biochemists at the University of Cambridge estimated the chance of a cell forming the way we've described is the equivalent of finding a single, get this, a single particular atom in the entire universe. It doesn't exist. It's impossible, which has left scientists to admit that they still have a theory without a beginning. And this is well attested to even by evolution's modern champion, Richard Dawkins. Don't know if you've heard of him or not, but this is the modern champion in the face of evolution. When Dawkins is pressed about how all of this could have really come into existence, he readily admits that he does not know, but perhaps it could have come from somewhere else in the universe. Since it doesn't make sense that it could happen here, perhaps alien life planted seed upon this earth. It's a theory called panspermia. Believing that somehow this super advanced civilization on another planet who got that way through its own mechanism of Darwinian evolution, planted life upon this earth. And I find it amazing that this guy, has an easier time believing that than believing in a God who creates. Now today, we've just looked at the beginning. And it's a simple beginning. Evolutionary science starts with the first cell formed out of a primordial soup. Math is our first refutation to show us that there is no chance that a cell could have crawled out of inorganic material in the first place. Next week, we're going to look at several more reasons why evolution cannot be true. I know that this is a different kind of lesson. I know that it's kind of more bookish than what you're used to. I hope that it won't bore you to death. I hope that you'll learn some things along the way. I do believe these are things that Christians ought to know. If you would, let's bow our heads together.